A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's had asthma since childhood, mostly well controlled, but there's one trigger that reliably blows things up, cigarette smoke. He describes the classic scenario. You're at a party. There are smokers. You don't want to make a scene. You stick around for 30 minutes. You feel fine in the moment. Then the next afternoon, the chest tightness hits, and suddenly you're in that spiral. Short of breath, anxious, not sure whether you can ride it out at home or need urgent care. He mentions his doctor prescribed prednisone as an emergency stockpile and basically told him, exhaust your rescue inhaler first, then take the oral steroids, and try not to bother us until you've done all that. He thinks that's bad advice, and he's asking for a practical, modern escalation plan that keeps an asthmatic safe without pretending an attack is just a dosing algorithm.
There's so much packed into this. The delayed reaction, the anxiety spiral, the question of when to escalate, and then the doctor's advice, which I think is worth examining carefully because it's not exactly wrong, but it's missing something crucial.
That's where I want to start. What's actually happening in the body during that gap? The 30 minutes of feeling fine, then the crash the next afternoon.
This is the late phase asthmatic response. Most people think of asthma as immediate. You inhale an irritant, your airways constrict within minutes, you reach for the inhaler. That's the early phase reaction. Mast cells in the airways degranulate, release histamine and leukotrienes, smooth muscle contracts. Fast, visible, scary. But the late phase reaction is what the prompt is describing. It kicks in roughly 4 to 12 hours after exposure, sometimes longer, and it's driven by a completely different mechanism. Inflammatory cells, particularly eosinophils and neutrophils, migrating into the airway tissue. The airways don't just constrict, they swell, they become hyper-responsive, they produce mucus. It's a slower burn, and it's often worse than the early phase.
You feel fine, because the inflammatory cavalry hasn't arrived yet.
And that's what makes it psychologically tricky. You think you dodged it, you go to bed, then you wake up at 3 in the morning or the next afternoon with that tightness, and it feels like it came out of nowhere. But it didn't. It was just the slow march of eosinophils.
Of course there are. And that's why the standard advice, just use your rescue inhaler, can feel so inadequate. Because by the time the late phase reaction is in full swing, albuterol is only addressing the bronchoconstriction piece. It's not touching the inflammation.
Albuterol is a beta agonist. It relaxes smooth muscle. It'll open the airways temporarily, but if the underlying problem is inflammatory swelling and mucus plugging, you're going to be reaching for that inhaler again in 2 hours. And that's where the escalation logic comes in, and why the doctor prescribed prednisone as a backup.
Let's get into that prednisone advice. The prompt calls it bad advice. I'm not sure I fully agree, but I also don't think the doctor communicated it well. What's the actual role of oral steroids in this kind of scenario?
Prednisone is the nuclear option for asthma exacerbations. It shuts down inflammation broadly, suppresses eosinophil activity, reduces airway edema, restores beta agonist responsiveness. The evidence for early oral steroids in moderate to severe exacerbations is strong. The landmark studies go back to the 1990s. Littenberg and others showed that giving prednisone early in an exacerbation reduces hospitalizations and relapse rates. The GINA guidelines, which are the global standard, recommend a short course of oral corticosteroids, typically 40 to 50 milligrams of prednisone daily for 5 to 7 days, for patients who don't respond adequately to increased reliever use.
The doctor's framing was, exhaust your inhaler first, then take the steroids, and don't bother us. That's where the problem lives, right? Not in the prescription itself, but in the sequence and the threshold.
The sequence matters enormously. Here's what I'd say. If you're using your rescue inhaler more than every 4 hours, and especially if you're not getting sustained relief, meaning you take 2 puffs, you feel better for maybe an hour, and then it comes right back. That's not a keep trying signal. That's an escalation signal. and waiting until you've done that for an entire day before starting prednisone is, I think, what the prompt's instinct is pushing back against. Because by then, you're already exhausted, anxious, and possibly deteriorating.
The anxiety piece isn't just psychological discomfort. It's physiologically relevant.
It absolutely is. Dyspnea, the sensation of air hunger, is one of the most primal distress signals the human body can generate. It activates the amygdala, it floods the system with cortisol and adrenaline, and that creates a feedback loop. Anxiety increases respiratory rate, which can lead to hyperventilation and increased work of breathing, which worsens the sensation of dyspnea, which increases anxiety. There's a paper from the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, I think from around 2022, that found asthma patients with comorbid anxiety had significantly higher rates of emergency department visits, independent of baseline asthma severity. It's not that anxiety causes the asthma, it's that anxiety makes an exacerbation harder to manage.
The doctors try not to bother us. Framing essentially ignores the fact that the patient is now in a panic spiral at 3 a.m, trying to decide whether this tightness is bad enough to act on. That's not a trivial thing to offload onto someone who can't breathe properly.
It's where I think a lot of asthma management fails. The medical model treats exacerbations as a dosing protocol. The lived experience is, I'm scared, I can't breathe, I don't know if this is going to get worse, and I'm alone with this decision. A good escalation plan has to account for both.
Let's build one. The prompt asks for a practical escalation plan. Walk me through what the modern consensus says, and let's make it usable for someone who's at home. It's maybe late at night. They've been exposed to a trigger, and they can feel things starting to tighten.
I'm going to structure this in phases, and I want to emphasize that this is based on GINA 2024 and 2025 guidance, plus what we know about the late phase response specifically. Phase 1 is what you do immediately after a known exposure, even before symptoms start. If you know you've been in a smoky room for 30 minutes and smoke is a known trigger, you don't wait for the tightness. You take your reliever inhaler preemptively, 2 puffs. And if you're on a maintenance inhaler that includes an inhaled corticosteroid, you take that as scheduled. Some people on combination inhalers like budesonide formoterol, which is a smart single maintenance and reliever therapy approach, can use that same inhaler for both maintenance and relief. GINA Track 1 actually recommends this as the preferred approach now.
The old model was, here's your brown preventer inhaler. Here's your blue reliever inhaler. Don't mix them up. The new model is, one inhaler can do both.
And this has been one of the biggest shifts in asthma management in the last decade. The SMART approach uses a combination of an inhaled corticosteroid and formoterol, which is a fast-onset, long-acting beta agonist, as both maintenance and reliever. The corticosteroid component means that every time you take a puff for symptom relief, you're also getting an anti-inflammatory dose. For the late phase response specifically, this is huge because you're addressing the inflammatory component early, not just the bronchoconstriction.
That feels like it directly addresses the gap. The old approach had you treating the constriction while the inflammation quietly built up. The SMART approach is hitting both from the start.
And the evidence bears this out. Systematic reviews show SMART reduces severe exacerbations by about 30 to 40% compared to traditional separate inhaler regimens. Now, not everyone is on SMART. Some people are still on separate ICS and reliever inhalers, and that's fine too. But the principle is the same. After a known trigger exposure, don't wait.
Phase 1 is preemptive reliever use and staying on maintenance. What's phase 2?
Phase 2 is when symptoms actually start. That chest tightness, the wheeze, the shortness of breath. The standard guidance is 2 puffs of your reliever inhaler. Wait 1 to 3 minutes, and if there's no improvement, take another 2 puffs. You can repeat this up to a total of, say, 8 to 12 puffs over the course of an hour. But, and this is the crucial but, if you're not getting sustained relief, if you're needing to repeat doses more frequently than every 3 to 4 hours, you're moving into phase 3. That's where the oral steroids come in.
This is where the doctor's advice and your framework diverge, I think. The doctor said, exhaust the inhaler, then steroids. You saying the threshold is lower.
The threshold should be lower. The GINA guidelines say, start oral corticosteroids if the patient fails to respond to increased reliever use over a short period, typically within the first hour or two of an exacerbation, not after a full day of suffering. The dose is usually 40 to 50 milligrams of prednisolone or prednisone daily for 5 to 7 days. And here's a point that often gets missed. You don't need to taper a short course. Tapering is for long-term steroid use to prevent adrenal insufficiency. A 5-day burst doesn't require a taper, which simplifies things enormously.
The practical version is, if you've taken your rescue inhaler multiple times in an hour and you're still struggling, start the prednisone. Don't wait until you've emptied the canister.
And I'd add a specific metric, peak flow. If you have a peak flow meter, and honestly, every asthmatic should, you can make this decision objectively. Take your baseline peak flow when you're well. If during an exacerbation your peak flow drops below 80% of your personal best, that's the yellow zone. Below 60% is the red zone. The yellow zone is where you increase reliever use and consider starting oral steroids if you're not improving. The red zone means you need urgent medical attention, period.
The prompt mentions that anxiety makes it hard to judge whether you're actually worse or just panicking. A peak flow number cuts through that.
It's an objective anchor. When you're anxious and dysmenic, your perception of severity is unreliable. The number isn't. And I think that's one of the most practical tools someone can have. It de-escalates the uncertainty spiral. You do the peak flow, you see the number, you know which zone you're in, and you follow the plan. It doesn't eliminate the anxiety, but it gives you a handrail.
The handrail metaphor is good. So we've got phase one, preemptive use after exposure. Phase two, reliever inhaler, monitoring frequency, peak flow checks. Phase three, oral steroids when reliever isn't giving sustained relief or peak flow drops into yellow. What's phase four?
Phase 4 is, this isn't working, I need medical help. And the triggers for that are specific. Peak flow below 60% of personal best and not improving after reliever. Inability to speak in full sentences. Using accessory muscles to breathe. You see the neck muscle straining, the ribs pulling in. A respiratory rate above 30 breaths per minute. Any bluish discoloration of the lips or fingernails, which is cyanosis and means oxygen levels are dropping. And here's a subtle one. If the reliever inhaler that normally works for you suddenly isn't doing anything, that's a red flag for severe bronchoconstriction or mucus plugging.
The anxiety piece gets worse here because someone in phase 4 is probably terrified. The prompt mentions that panic spiral specifically, being suddenly short of breath is scary, and being anxious probably doesn't help the breathing. Is there anything you can do in that moment, practically, that isn't just try to calm down?
There is, and I think this is under-discussed in asthma care. Pursed lip breathing is the simplest and most evidence-backed technique. You inhale slowly through your nose for 2 counts, then exhale through pursed lips, like you're blowing through a straw, for 4 counts. What this does is create back pressure in the airways, which helps keep them open during exhalation. It also slows the respiratory rate, which counteracts the hyperventilation that anxiety drives. It's not a replacement for medication, but it can buy you time and reduce the sense of air hunger.
It's the breathing equivalent of not yanking the steering wheel.
And there's a related technique called diaphragmatic breathing, belly breathing, where you focus on expanding the abdomen rather than the chest. This engages the diaphragm more effectively and reduces the work of the accessory muscles in the neck and shoulders. In an acute exacerbation, those accessory muscles are already working overtime. Shifting the load to the diaphragm can reduce the sensation of effort.
Both of those feel like things you could actually remember to do when you're panicking. Unlike, try to relax.
Try to relax is the least helpful thing you can say to someone who can't breathe. It's up there with, just take a deep breath. If someone could take a deep breath, they wouldn't be in this situation.
There's also a positioning thing, right? I remember reading that lying flat can make asthma worse.
The tripod position, sitting upright, leaning slightly forward, hands on knees, is the body's natural response to severe dyspnea, and it's effective. It optimizes the mechanics of the diaphragm and accessory muscles. Lying flat reduces lung volumes and can worsen the sensation of breathlessness. So if you're struggling, sit up, lean forward, do pursed lip breathing. That's your immediate physical toolkit.
So, to recap the escalation plan we built so far, phase 1 is preemptive reliever use after a known trigger exposure, plus staying on maintenance therapy. Phase 2 is treating breakthrough symptoms with reliever, monitoring peak flow, and watching the clock. Phase 3 is starting oral steroids. 40 to 50 milligrams of prednisone for 5 to 7 days. No taper needed. When reliever isn't giving sustained relief or peak flow drops below 80%. Phase 4 is recognizing when you need emergency care. Peak flow below 60%. Can't speak in sentences, accessory muscle use, cyanosis, or reliever not working at all. Plus the physical toolkit. Pursed lip breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, tripod position.
That's the scaffold. And I think it's important to say that this scaffold exists so you don't have to think through all of this in the moment. You make the plan when you're well. You write it down. You keep the prednisone and the peak flow meter and the inhaler in one place. When the exacerbation hits, you're not deciding. You're executing.
That's the preparedness philosophy from those earlier episodes bleeding in. The time to figure out your escalation thresholds is not when you're gasping at 2 in the morning.
And I want to add one more layer to this, which is the follow-up. After you've taken a course of oral steroids and the exacerbation has resolved, you should see your doctor within a week or two. Not necessarily because something went wrong, but because an exacerbation severe enough to need oral steroids is a signal that your baseline control might not be adequate. It's what Gina calls a risk factor for future exacerbations. Having had one exacerbation requiring oral steroids in the past 12 months is itself a predictor of future events. So it should trigger a review of your maintenance regimen.
Which loops back to something the prompt hinted at. The doctor's approach was hands-off, almost to the point of minimizing. The prompt says, I think this is actually bad advice, and it underestimates what going through an attack is like. I think there's a tension here worth exploring. On one hand, the doctor's approach reflects a real trend in asthma management toward patient self-management and avoiding unnecessary emergency visits. On the other hand, it can tip into what feels like abandonment.
This is a real tension in chronic disease management broadly. The shift toward self-management is evidence-based. Asthma action plans that empower patients to adjust their own medications, reduce hospitalizations, and improve outcomes. There's solid data on this. But self-management doesn't mean you're on your own. It means here's a clear protocol, here are the thresholds, and here's when to call us. The doctor in the prompt seems to have given the protocol without the thresholds and with an implicit message of, don't call unless you absolutely have to. That's not self-management. That's just being left alone with a bottle of prednisone.
The psychological cost of that is real. The prompt describes that uncertainty, the time between when you try to increase the dose of something and you wonder whether it's actually going to work or not. That's a window of dread. A good escalation plan shrinks that window by giving you clear decision points.
It also legitimizes the decision to escalate. One of the things I saw in my practice, and that the literature bears out, is that patients often delay seeking care because they don't want to be seen as overreacting. They'll tell themselves it's probably nothing. They'll try to tough it out, and by the time they show up in the emergency department, they're in far worse shape than they needed to be. A written action plan with objective criteria. Peak flow numbers, reliever use frequency, specific symptoms, gives permission to act. It externalizes the decision. It's not, am I overreacting? It's my plan says 60% means go.
That's almost a psychological intervention, as much as a medical one. The plan absorbs the self-doubt.
And I think it's worth mentioning that the anxiety-asthma connection has gotten more research attention in the last few years. There was a study from the Journal of Asthma, I want to say 2023, that looked at cognitive behavioral therapy interventions specifically for asthma-related anxiety. They found that CBT reduced both anxiety scores and, notably, the frequency of reliever inhaler use. The mechanism wasn't that the asthma got better, it was that patients got better at distinguishing between anxiety-driven dyspnea and actual bronchoconstriction, and they responded more appropriately to each.
There's a calibration problem. Anxiety mimics asthma symptoms. Asthma symptoms trigger anxiety, and without a framework, you're just ricocheting between them.
The framework we've been building, the escalation plan with objective criteria, is essentially a poor man's version of that calibration. It gives you something external to check your perception against.
Let me pull on one more thread from the prompt. He mentions being hospitalized once, put on a nebulizer. The nebulizer versus inhaler question. Is there a point in the escalation where a nebulizer at home makes sense, or is that outdated?
The evidence on home nebulizers is actually interesting and somewhat counterintuitive. multiple studies have shown that a metered dose inhaler with a spacer is at least as effective as a nebulizer for delivering albuterol, even in moderate to severe exacerbations, provided the technique is correct. A spacer, that plastic tube you attach the inhaler to, essentially does what a nebulizer does. It creates a cloud of medication that you can inhale over several breaths, rather than trying to coordinate the actuation with your inhalation. The coordination piece is hard when you're dyspneic and anxious. A spacer removes that variable.
The spacer is the unsung hero here.
It really is. And it's cheap, it's portable, it doesn't require electricity. For most people, a spacer plus a metered dose inhaler is the practical equivalent of a nebulizer treatment. Where nebulizers still have a role is in very severe exacerbations where someone can't coordinate any inhalation effort, or in settings where you're delivering continuous albuterol. But that's an emergency department thing, not a home thing.
If someone's building their asthma emergency kit, the checklist is reliever inhaler, spacer, peak flow meter, prednisone, written action plan with thresholds, maybe a pulse oximeter.
Pulse oximeters are a double-edged sword in asthma. The problem is that oxygen saturation can remain normal even during a significant exacerbation. Unlike COPD or pneumonia, where desaturation is an early warning sign, asthma attacks often preserve oxygenation until quite late. This is because the problem in asthma is primarily ventilation, getting air out, not oxygenation. The blood that does get oxygenated is fine. The problem is that not enough air is moving. So a normal pulse ox reading can be falsely reassuring. I've seen asthmatics with peak flows below 40% who still had oxygen saturations above 95%.
You could be in real trouble, and the little number on the finger clip says everything's fine.
That's why peak flow is a better home monitoring tool for asthma specifically. It measures what's actually impaired, airflow. Pulse oximetry is useful if you're worried about a concurrent issue or if someone has a mixed picture. But for a straightforward asthma exacerbation at home, I'd prioritize peak flow.
That's a useful corrective. I think a lot of people assume the pulse oximeter is the universal respiratory distress tool.
It's been overgeneralized, partly because of the pandemic. Everyone bought pulse oximeters, and now they're in medicine cabinets everywhere. For asthma, the peak flow meter is the more appropriate home device.
Let's circle back to the trigger itself. Cigarette smoke. Is there anything specific about smoke as a trigger that makes the late phase response more likely or more severe?
Cigarette smoke is a particularly nasty trigger because it's not a single irritant. It's a complex mixture of thousands of chemicals, many of which are direct airway irritants and some of which are pro-inflammatory. The particulate matter in smoke can penetrate deep into the small airways, which is where a lot of the late-phase inflammatory action happens. There's also evidence that smoke exposure can transiently increase airway hyperresponsiveness for days afterward, meaning that subsequent exposures to other triggers, cold air, exercise, allergens, will provoke a stronger reaction than they normally would.
The 30 minutes at the party isn't just triggering an isolated event, it's lowering the threshold for everything else for days.
That's the part that I think gets underestimated. People think, well, I was only there for half an hour, I didn't even cough. But the inflammatory cascade has been primed. And then 2 days later, you go for a run in cool air and suddenly you're wheezing and you don't connect it to the party. But the connection is there.
Which makes the preemptive approach even more important. If you know you've been exposed, assume the inflammatory cascade is underway and act accordingly.
And this is where the smart approach with budesonide formoterol really shines, because every reliever dose delivers an anti-inflammatory hit. Even if you're not feeling symptoms yet, you're addressing the process that's already in motion.
What if someone isn't on smart? What if they're on the traditional separate inhalers, a maintenance corticosteroid and a short-acting beta agonist for relief?
Then the approach is slightly different, but the principle is the same. After a known exposure, take your reliever preemptively. And if you're on a separate inhaled corticosteroid, make absolutely sure you're taking it as prescribed. Don't skip doses in the days following the exposure, even if you feel fine. Some guidelines actually suggest temporarily doubling the dose of inhaled corticosteroid for a short period after a significant trigger exposure, though the evidence on this is mixed. The more robust recommendation is to be vigilant about adherence and to have a low threshold for starting oral steroids if symptoms break through.
The doubling, the preventer thing isn't as settled as I might have assumed.
It was a common recommendation for years, and some doctors still advise it. But the randomized trials, there was a big one in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think around 2018, found that quadrupling the dose, not just doubling, was needed to see a reduction in severe exacerbations. And even then, the effect was modest. The current GINA guidance has moved away from the double your ICS approach and toward either the SMART regimen or early oral steroids for clear exacerbations.
That's a significant shift. It means someone following old advice from 10 years ago might be undertreating themselves.
That's exactly why these plans need periodic review. Asthma guidelines have evolved substantially in the last decade. The SMART approach, the de-emphasis on doubling ICS, the clearer thresholds for oral steroids, the recognition of the anxiety component. All of this is relatively recent. Someone whose last asthma education was in 2015 is operating on outdated information.
To the prompt's question about the modern consensus. The modern consensus is, treat early, treat inflammation, use objective monitoring, have clear thresholds, and don't tough it out. The old model of wait until you're really sick has been replaced by intercept the exacerbation before it gains momentum.
That's a good summary, and I'd add one more element. The modern consensus recognizes that asthma is heterogeneous. The prompt describes a specific phenotype, someone with a clear trigger, a predictable late phase response, and an anxiety component. The escalation plan needs to be personalized to that phenotype. A generic, use your inhaler and call if it gets worse, doesn't cut it.
Because if it gets worse, is doing a lot of interpretive work at 3 in the morning when you're scared and can't breathe.
If it gets worse, is not a threshold, it's a vibe. And you cannot run a medical escalation on vibes.
Let's make this concrete. If the prompt's author is listening, and he's building his written action plan tonight, what are the bullet points?
Step 1. Identify your personal best peak flow when you're well. That's your baseline. Step 2. Define your zones. Green is above 80% of baseline. You're good. Continue maintenance. Yellow is 60 to 80%. This is the caution zone. Increase reliever use. If you're not back in green within an hour or two, or if you're needing reliever more than every 3 to 4 hours, start oral steroids, 40 to 50 milligrams of prednisone, once daily, for 5 to 7 days. Step 3, red zone is below 60% of baseline, or symptoms that don't respond to reliever at all, or can't speak in full sentences, or using neck muscles to breathe. That's emergency department time. Don't wait, don't second guess, just go. Step 4, after any known trigger exposure, cigarette smoke, in this case, take reliever preemptively, even before symptoms start. Step 5, keep everything in one place. Inhaler, spacer, peak flow meter, prednisone, written plan. Step 6, review the plan with your doctor annually, or after any exacerbation that required oral steroids or an emergency visit.
The anxiety toolkit alongside it. Pursed lip breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, tripod position. None of these replace medication, but they give you something to do while the medication kicks in.
The medication works on the physiology. The breathing techniques work on the panic. You need both, because the panic is part of the physiology.
That feels like the core insight of this whole discussion. Asthma isn't just a bronchoconstriction problem. It's a bronchoconstriction problem, plus an inflammation problem, plus a perception problem. And the perception problem, the anxiety, the uncertainty, the second guessing, is what makes an exacerbation feel unmanageable at home. A good plan addresses all three.
I think that's where the prompt's frustration with the doctor's advice is most justified. The doctor addressed the bronchoconstriction. Here's your inhaler, and the inflammation. Here's your prednisone. But she didn't address the perception problem. She didn't give thresholds. She didn't give permission. She didn't acknowledge that being short of breath at 2 in the morning is terrifying, and that a plan needs to account for that terror, not just the pharmacology.
It's the difference between, here are your tools, figure it out, and here is your protocol. You know exactly what to do, and you know exactly when to get help.
That second framing is not just kinder, it's more effective. The data on written asthma action plans shows they reduce emergency visits, reduce hospitalizations, and reduce days lost to asthma symptoms. This isn't just about making patients feel better emotionally, it's about outcomes.
The modern consensus, boiled down, have a written plan. Know your zones, treat early, use objective monitoring, don't wait to escalate, and build the anxiety management into the protocol, rather than treating it as a separate problem.
That's it. And I'd say, to the prompt's author specifically, your instinct was right. The doctor's advice wasn't malicious, but it was incomplete. The missing piece was the decision framework, the handrail. Build that framework, write it down, and then when the late phase response hits, you're not deciding whether it's bad enough. You're following the plan.
That's the whole thing, isn't it? The plan makes the decision, so you don't have to.
Korn. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, practitioners of Yagli Gureg, Turkish oil wrestling, discovered that a competitor's skin, when coated in olive oil and viewed under the low-angle light of late afternoon, exhibits an optical property known as specular gloss, which makes the body appear approximately 23% more massive than it actually is, a phenomenon that some wrestlers exploited by timing their most theatrical holds for the hour when shadows lengthen and opponents appear most formidable to the crowd.
Right. To close, the thing I keep coming back to is how much of chronic disease management comes down to this gap between what the doctor prescribes and what the patient actually experiences in the middle of the night. Closing that gap isn't about more medication. It's about better decision architecture. And that's something anyone can build.
The question I'd leave listeners with is, if you have a chronic condition, do you have a written plan with clear thresholds, or do you have a vibe? Because vibes don't hold up at 3 in the morning.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you found this useful, share it with someone who might need an escalation plan of their own.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.